Blog Talk Radio.
Season 5, Episode 12 of The Hollywood Connection. I am the host of the most, Jimmy Falcon, and by my side today is actor Sandy Helberg.
Hello.
I guess the third time was the charm. Glad to have you.
Nice to be had. After all, it took us three times, you know.
Yeah, it's unfortunate what you guys were going through with the wildfires, and a lot of life and a lot of homes and such have been lost. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, it was terrible. It really was terrible. It was like so out of control. It's like nothing anyone can do, you know. Even evacuating, which I did, you don't want to come home and there's the chimney. That's all that's standing. I've seen that before.
Wow. But,
so anyway, but thank God we got through it. And here I am.
Well, I'm happy to have you. I found it interesting to see that you are the son of Holocaust survivors who met in a concentration camp. That had to be a very interesting upbringing.
Yes, it was. It was, at first I thought it was normal till I realized what else is going on out there. I was born in Germany, and my parents spent 6 years. They were both at Auschwitz. And when we came here, I was about a year old. And, the way they describe it, they were 13 when they went in. My father's brother was a barber, and so he had taught my father how to cut hair. So my father knew how to cut hair, and he cut the soldiers, the Nazis' hair, because he was 13. And then he'd go on the women's side and cut the soldiers' hair there. And he'd go back and forth. And he had a sister on the women's side. And his sister was hanging out with this cute little bald woman. And, they all had their heads shaved. And you know what? With everything that was going on, the two of them, they never spoke, not in the camps, and just spotted each other. And, I don't know how you even do that with what's going on around you, but maybe it was some form of, comfort. I don't know. And then after the war, they sort of got lost, and my father traveled around Europe until he tracked her down.
Wow.
And then when they were in the camps, they had no hair and they weighed about 90 pounds. My father, after the war, he had a watch. He traded the watch for a bicycle. He rode around in Poland, finally found her, and she couldn't believe it. She didn't recognize him. He had a huge head of hair and a big suit and weighed 93 pounds. And he took her out for a walk, and he said he wanted her to come with him. She said, no, I have a fiancé. He's in the Polish army, and he's still on the front lines. What was interesting was the war was over, but I don't know what happened to this guy. So my father walks her to the train station, and there's like no electricity, and he gets on the train, and she stands on the platform. He says, come with me. She says, no, I can't. He says, if you come with me, I take care of you for your whole life. And he gave her a yank, and they were married over 60 years.
Wow.
And he did take care of her. He did take care of her. She never had to work. He came to this country as a barber. I was about a year old. We were in Toledo, Ohio, which is what I've always said. When the three of us got to Toledo, we had doubled the Jewish population. And and that was it. You know, he worked as a barber and then bought barber shops and bought old real estate, fixed it up, and then got into huge commercial development and became very successful.
Well, that's
which
great.
Is why he wondered why I wanted to go into show business when I could work for him in Toledo, Ohio.
Well, that's kind of how I've always thought. I live in outside of a town of 500. I guess I felt like if I didn't surround myself with some sort of celebrities, then I was really going to have nothing in, except corn in my life.
No, well, there's some celebrity porn, but, you know, the thing is also for me, there was still a lot of anti-Semitism. You know, this is Toledo, Ohio. I was a little Jew boy from Germany, and they thought I was a German, so they used to call me Hitler. I'm sorry, did you get that?
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, they used to call the house and ask for Hitler. But anyway, I told my father, I said, no, that means they like me. Please don't be angry. But so that's how I honestly developed my sense of humor. I wasn't real good in school. I wasn't an athlete. I was being harassed by rednecks. And that's how a lot of people got through the Holocaust. My father had an amazingly sarcastic sense of humor. And what he said to me years after when I was working and on TV, you know, doing comedy with the Groundlings, he was pretty egotistical. He looked at me one time. He said, you know, I was the funniest guy in the camps. And I said to him, now, that's a tough crowd. So anyway, that's that. So,
it's interesting. It's interesting you bring up the Groundlings. That was actually where I was heading. You know, being an original member of such a iconic performing group, oh, my goodness. So many great names coming through, like Phil Hartman and Paul Rubin, John Paragon, Julius Sweeney. How did that all come about with the Groundlings? Where did it, why did it, you know, like what was the reason for starting this group?
I had just come from New York to L.A., and someone mentioned there's an improv group sort of getting started, and Gary Austin is the one who started it, and he was in the committee, and he was involved with Second City, and so he wanted to start his own group, and he found this crummy theater in L.A., it was like 30 seats, and so he was just putting it together, and I showed up, and said, I heard you're starting an improvisational group. He said, yes. I said, how many seats? 30. He said, I said, what do I have to do to join? He said, you have $45. I said, yes. He said, you're in. And that was it. There were about 8 to 10 people in the whole group. The theater was tiny, and I just loved doing improvisation and got to work with a lot of fun people and, so that's how it is. So I was in and out of there for 10, 12 years. I leave for a few months, come back. So it was great. And then people started finally coming to the show. And like Phil Hartman, he had come to see a show. And he said he realized that's what he wanted to do. So he and I did a lot of stuff together.
Yeah, Phil Hartman is definitely one of my favorite actors. He was such a hilarious impersonator and actor.
And he was such a good guy. He really was. You know, when he came, this is years ago after he'd already left the Groundlings, he was leaving Saturday Night Live, and he came out to our place. And my son was just a little boy, and he sat him down. He said, yeah, I saw your father. I went to that show, and he said to my son, he said, he was one of the funniest guys I'd ever seen. And he said, that's what I wanted to do. And I said, you haven't seen any funnier guys than me since then, have you? He said, well, just a few, you know, not too many. But he was just a good guy, a real mensch. That was shocking. That whole thing happened on my birthday.
Really?
I woke up and I hear the news, comedy legend dies. I'm thinking Milton Berle, Bob Hope. Never never imagining, you know. I mean, to have a friend, let alone to know someone that that happened to, was just unimaginable.
Yeah,
but
Phil
anyway,
Hartman, he was definitely an icon.
He was in a short time, you know. But
and of course, you have been in some great films with the iconic Mel Brooks. How did you meet Mel, and what are some of your funny memories from working with him?
Well, he look, he was always an idol, you know, to me, as a young guy. You know, the Marx Brothers, Mel Brooks, you know. Still the Three Stooges once in a while, only if the Curly's in it. And so I had a friend, I don't know if you know this actor, Jack Riley.
No, I don't believe so.
Do you remember the old Bob Newhart show?
Yeah.
He played... now I can't remember his name in the show, Mr. Carlin. You know, he was like the uptight guy in the tie and always
okay.
kind of nasty to the women. So he was friends with Mel, and he thought I was funny, and he said, would you like to meet Mel Brooks? And I thought he was kidding. He sets up an appointment. I go to Mel's office, and I open the door to walk in, and his office is the size of like Madison Square Garden. And I'm walking and walking, and I'm getting more and more nervous as I'm getting closer to his desk. And I finally get to his desk, and I'm, like, sweating. He said, it took you long enough to get here. And I sat down, and we just talked. And at one point, I finally made him laugh, and I stood up. He said, where are you going? I said, I made you laugh. I'm done. I can get out of show business. I said, there's nothing else that I want to do. He said, sit down, sit down. And he said, you came in for a small part. I like you. I'm going to give you a bigger small part. So the first one was High Anxiety. And, you know, with Mel, you got to improvise. He liked to use the same people because he liked to improvise. But if you tell that to some people, they get a little carried away. But, so, you know, every time it was just an amazing experience to work with him and Madeline Kahn in High Anxiety. And then in, what was the second one? What was that? Oh, History of the World. That was a great experience. The original thing in History of the World, I played Einstein. He played Hitler and someone played Sigmund Freud. And we sing while we ice skate. So... he shot all that. I had a 2.5-hour makeup with the wig and the mustache, and I don't sing. We had to come back and sing it. And then he called me a few weeks later and said he looked at it and cut it together, and he didn't like it. So he'd like me to come back. He had another role for me to do. I was thrilled. So I played one of the apostles in the Last Supper scene and got to work with John Hurt, who played Jesus. So, then he'd keep calling me, you want to come back? I got Richard Pryor coming in. Richard Pryor was supposed to be in that too. And so he had me come. I met Richard Pryor, and he took Richard around the set to show it to him. Next day, Richard burns up, and he had to bring Gregory Hines in. So that's how that happened. And then, Spaceballs, at one point, at the end of the scene, when I'm leaving, I say to Dark Helmet or Big Helmet, I say, I'm going to go home and work on my putts. And Mel laughs, the elf cut, and calls me over. He said, that's a great joke. I got to give it to Rick Moranis because he's the star of the movie. That should have the last line or joke. I said, okay, if I have an idea. He said, sure, sure, sure. So I came up with the idea of, in that scene, making out with the nurse when the lights went out. I thought, see, my ego's not that big. If I get to make out with a hot girl, Rick can have the joke. But he's just a great guy. He also gave us just a mensch. And, you know, I'm grateful to have worked with him, and I'm grateful that he likes me. So, like I said, it's one of those things when you're younger and you want to be an actor, you can't imagine that you know, he would be doing three films with Mel Brooks. He'd just call, look, I got the part, come on in. He said, let your agents worry about the money. I said, well, that's good. So that's how it went. That's how the business is, you know, from one person to another, or it takes an introduction, and it either works or it doesn't work, you know. If you spark right away. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's Mel Brooks. I'd run into him a lot, and he was just a lot of fun. We went to he and I and a bunch of other people went to a memorial for this friend of ours, and there is a website that has people who've worked with Mel Brooks the most. And now, since this guy died, Mel said at the memorial, he said, I think now Sandy takes the first place, from second place to first place. And I said, no, please, I don't want to. Look what happened to the last guy that was first place. I said, I don't make me, you know, I don't want to be in the Deadpool.
This isn't the list I want to be on.
Yeah, that's not. It's okay being in the list with the most movies, but not number one because he died. So,
right.
So, you know, he's 92 and he's got as much energy and he's just always out there doing things. You know?
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
and of course, your son is a great actor.
That's what I hear. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, I wanted to ask you about him, and I don't know why I ever thought to not ask somebody about this, but what are your feelings on the paparazzi? Because I've seen some pictures of you and him and your granddaughters out there. I mean, that's pretty intrusive.
It is, not for me just at one time, but how is it for him? He handles it pretty well. He's kind of low-key and calm, and we were at this Malibu chili fair, you know, people spot him, but they're polite. You know, they come over, they ask him for an autograph. But at one point, we were taking his daughter back to the car, and that was scary. There must have been 10 of the paparazzi, like, running after us. And we got to his car, and he was trying to put his daughter in the car seat, and they surrounded. And I just, I played security. I just had to get him back them off so he could get his daughter in the car, and we can get the hell out of there. But, otherwise, as far as his everyday thing, I don't know. I don't know. You know, look, you put a hat on and glasses, you can disappear. If you want to be recognized, you go out and look like your TV character.
Very true.
Yeah. So he's wrapping up. This is their last year.
Yeah, that show's had a great run.
Yeah, 13 years. That's pretty good.
And I did, I guess, wrapping up, I wanted to ask you about the Love Boat pilot where you played a gopher.
Yeah. Yeah, we, you know, same thing. They were auditioning people for weeks. And at that time I had longer hair and I had a beard and they kept having me come back. And then they sort of said that they were interested. They said, would you cut your hair and shave your beard? They said, you know, I mean, we pretty much, I said, fine. I came back, cut hair, shaved beard, sit on the couch, and there's a guy who looks just like me. So I thought, so he went in and read, and then I saw him leave. And then they had me come in, I read, and the producer said, would the groundlings be able to get along without you this weekend? I said, who? The groundlings? I don't know who they are. I'm with you guys. And that was it, you know, and, we went on a cruise around Ensenada. The original doc was Dick Van Patten. And the captain was an Australian actor. I don't remember his name. The cruise director was also a woman from New York. I don't know her name. Teddy Wilson was the bartender. He was a terrific actor. So it was like a year later that they were going to do another one. And at that time, I was doing another show, and they wouldn't let me out. So that's showbiz history. But you know what? It was fine. I worked with great people on that, with Cloris Leachman and Tom Bosley and Florence Henderson was in the pilot, and
oh wow,
yeah, Gabe Kaplan. It was not too exciting. Don Adams. He was a character, a strange
yeah,
guy.
Get smart.
But yeah, get smart. And so, yeah, so it, again, it was an ABC show, so they had all of their ABC actors on it, you know, guest stars. So, yeah, so it didn't get picked up until the next year. And like I said, I was doing a series for Metro Media, and they wouldn't let me out for 2 weeks.
It's interesting how sometimes the pilots and the show afterward can have a completely different cast.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you'd be amazed. Laverne and Shirley, Penny Marshall was doing it, and they wanted Cindy Williams, and she didn't want to do it. And so I used a friend of mine who was in the Groundlings, this woman, and she did the pilot. She played Shirley, and the pilot got picked up, and Cindy Williams said, okay, I'll do the show.
Wow.
That's what happened. Yeah. I mean, I just have time. I have a Jerry Van Dyke show. Talk about show business. His friend was Sheldon Bull. He said, I'm creating a part for you in a new show called Newhart. He said, it's yours. You're in it. I'm writing it for you. He calls Jerry Van Dyke. He says, CBS wants to meet. He says, please don't make me meet them. That's where I fuck it up. He had to meet them. The guy had to call Jerry and say, look, Bob Newhart wanted his friend Tom Poston to do the part. And Jerry goes out furniture shopping with his wife, and he's just distraught. And he's in this furniture store, and two guys come in with guns to rob the store, and they tell everyone to lay on the floor. And Jerry says, fuck you, I'm not laying on the floor. Go ahead, shoot me. I just lost the job of a lifetime. And he went crazy and scared these guys out of the store. And they said he was standing on Ventura Boulevard. Go ahead, shoot me. I don't care. But then Sheldon Bull did make it up to him. He wrote him, put him in Coach.
Yeah, the Van Dyke brothers are great actors and Illinois boys themselves, so we're very proud of them.
Yes, absolutely. So, yeah, I see all the time. Again, it's that thing of as a kid, he was also an idol to watch his show. And here he is, you know. It's like, to me, it's like I just came from another planet and here's Dick Van Dyke, you know.
Wow.
But, there, you know, it was, you're around, you meet a lot of people, you know, you work with a lot of people. Some of it's good, some of it's not so good, but, working with Barbara Streisand was difficult, but she was the boss.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, the last question I always like to ask everybody, Sandy, is what does the future hold for you? What do you got coming up that you would like to tell us?
Well, I've been doing a solo show. I haven't done it for a while because my wife of 43 years and I have a two-and-a-half-year-old baby. So, look, who knew I was still so fertile? But it's our younger son's daughter, and we're raising her, and we've had her since she's 4 months, 4 months old, and she's ours. She's 2 and a half. Oh, she's just amazing. But anyway, I've been doing a solo show at the Groundling Theater. It's called You Can Only Blame So Much on the Holocaust. And it's about me growing up in Toledo, coming from Germany. My parents only spoke Yiddish to me, so when I started school, I sounded like Jackie Mason. Come on, boys, you hit the ball, I got it on the bases. I slide in, I hit it, and these are rednecks in Toledo with overalls. And they'd look at me and say, can I swear? I already did once. Can I swear? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure, go ahead.
They looked at me and said, what the fuck is he saying? And so they did let me play. I was home plate. But there was, like I said, a lot of anti-Semitism. It was Toledo, small city in Ohio, and here comes a bunch of Jews who have accents. But like I said, knock on wood, my father became very successful and owned a lot of real estate. He just was able to sort of see the future. And he said, yeah, we can all go to New York, but everything has been done in New York. And all the other relatives went to New York, Chicago, Toronto. But then we got sent to Toledo because we had a sponsor here. And he was right. He said it's easier to make money in a smaller town because whatever you come up with is new. So he started out with one barbershop, wound up with five, sold them real estate, building malls, you know. And this is all after spending 6 years in the camp, never having a formal education.
Wow.
He was also very narcissistic and egotistical. I guess that would kind of come with the territory of surviving what he survived, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So my wife and I went back to Auschwitz a couple of years ago, and it just, you know, to see where they were, and it just kind of knocks the wind out of you. But we were in Czechoslovakia, so I decided to rent a car to drive to Auschwitz. And we're on our way, and I get stopped by the police for speeding. And, you know, I don't know what they're talking about. They don't know what I'm talking about. They finally say, go. And I told this to someone, and they said, I would never imagine that two Jews were in such a hurry to get to Auschwitz, they got a speeding ticket.
Yeah, that's something.
But it was, like I said, it is just, again, looking at those barracks and thinking, that's where my parents were for 6 years. And you can still smell the ash, and you can still, most of the barracks are gone, but there's still a few standing. The tall chimneys from the, crematoriums. My aunts went through it, my uncles. I never had any grandparents. I never saw them. None of them survived, my mother's or my father's. And so that also, for me, set me apart. You know, in all America, the little German Jew boy. And on weekends, I'm going to grandma's house. We're going to grandpa's house and milk a cow. I didn't have any grandparents. I didn't milk a cow. You know, we never went fishing. The only way we would go fishing, my father would say, you want to go fishing? Come on. And he'd take me to a deli, and he'd say, we can pick out lox, whitefish, you know. That was fishing to him. No, he didn't play baseball, basketball, but he did play soccer.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was very neat. That's great that, you know, he was able to overcome all the adversity and everything that he went through and became very successful.
Yes. Yeah. Well, to him, every day was sort of a gift, and he made the most of it, and he was a good talker, a good bullshitter, you know. Honestly, I know he felt if he could survive and bullshit the Nazis, he can survive and bullshit anyone. And he did. That's how he became very successful.
Wow.
So that's
well,
it.
Well, thank you so very much for joining me, Sandy. It was great. We finally got together.
Yes, absolutely. So you'll send me a copy of this or something?
I can send you the link to it. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Time's up. Okay. I'm afraid someone's going to come in here with a Glock in the door.
Not quite. All right, yeah, she gets annoying, but
okay.
You know, I guess there's only so much time.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it, and maybe we'll talk again.
Absolutely. I look forward to it. Have a great
okay.
night. Thanks again.
You too. All right, thanks.
Bye-bye. All right, big thanks to Sandy Hellberg, and of course, as always, thank you, everybody, for listening. We will be back in December. I will have the show. It's actually December 6th, so stay tuned for the guest info. And I already said it once again. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great night.
Would you like to sponsor the Cloverleaf Radio Network? We'd love for you to be our friend. We have several packages available, and some start out just as low as 99 cents a month. All you need to do is to click on that little link that you see that says support our network. You can support our network for 99 cents a month, $4.99 a month, or $9.99 a month. But if you be our best friend and you sponsor us for $9.99 a month, you'll get to be a part of Cherry House Press, which is another company part of the Cloverleaf Radio Network. We'll send you the newest published book every time that we published, just because you decided to be our friend for $9.99 a month. We thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.